This summer, Hadar hosted a seminar exploring the world of Midrash, and I'm excited to share a few of the classes from this seminar with you in the next few episodes. We will start with a class from Hadar Rosh Yeshiva, Rabbi Aviva Richman. The class is titled Rain, Dew, Wind, Storm, The Quest for Nourishing Torah. Through a discussion of Midrashim on the Book of Devarim, Rav Aviva dives into the various roles of Torah as intermediary, a place for grief, joy, atonement, darkness, and more. She teaches that Torah, like rain, is limitless. Let's listen in.
So I'm actually going to turn it over to Hannah Kapnick-Ashar, who's a member of our Kollel, our Advanced Rabbinic Training Program. She's been spending and devoting a lot of time to the study of Midrash in the past few months, especially. And she's going to guide us in a short reflection, and then we'll come back together and do one final chunk of learning together.
Hello, I'm Hannah. And so grateful myself for this week of learning Midrash. It's been such a pleasure to be learning with you all. And I want to think together, invite us to be enjoying for a minute, kind of tzitzikering, lingering in the texture of what Midrash is and can be. For me, I feel like the experience of learning Midrash feels like getting to be in the shallow end and the deep end of the pool at the same time. There's such richness and such a sense of the different layers and potentials of Torah and of how the ideas that we care so deeply about can be enriched by being in dialogue with the Torah that we cherish and are accountable to. So I want to invite some reflection by sharing a quote from Daniel Boyarin to help us think about what Midrash offers, and then we'll do some reflecting on it. So he writes, "Poised thus, between intertextuality and history." And what he means by that is talking about academic approaches and of reading Midrash as being purely intertextual, which is to say it's only the rabbis putting one text from the Hebrew Bible, from the Tanakh, in dialogue with another text or several other texts from Tanakh in a way that's kind of clean of their own input. It's purely looking at the language that's there. And history is the academic approach that says they're purely bringing in their own experience and putting it on the text. So he's saying that it's actually between these two dimensions of using purely what's there in Tanakh to put itself in dialogue with itself, or history where they're bringing their lives onto the text. Midrash reveals the inadequacy of any model of culture which divorces one way of making meaning from another. The Torah read and lives lived are equally processes of making reality yield human meaning, and Midrash subsumes them both. I read it one more time. Starting from here, Midrash reveals the inadequacy of any model of culture which divorces one way of making meaning from another. The Torah read and lives lived are equally processes of making reality yield human meaning, and Midrash subsumes them both.
Close your eyes and see what image, color, might emerge as you close your eyes and just take in the learning. Is there something that you have a clearer sense about in terms of what Midrash can do? What Midrash can do for Torah, what Midrash can do for you, what Midrash must do for us. We're going to actually give a moment of closing your eyes and really just seeing what kind of distinct or amorphous color or image appears. I'll give us a little bit of background music as we do this. thanks for going there with all of us. You know, we're often in a very text focused mode, and just wanted to give a chance for some of your own relationship to all the text to emerge.
We would love to hear two or three voices just sharing the on one foot version of what you're taking away about the potential of Midrash. Yeah, let's start with Morty.
My insight, which just came during the conversation we had, is this kind of the top layer of Midrash is the people who presented and the teachers, because each one of them has a different style. Each one of them kind of looks at the Midrash or the Midrash on the Midrash to whatever level in a different way. So I hope it's other people's sentiment too. Thank you very much for your layer of the Midrash on top of the materials that you provided. Thank you.
And I'll share that when Rav Aviva invited us to go into images or how we relate to Midrash, part of how we even came to that prompt was because we've been talking together this week about, like, how do we want to frame how we think about Midrash? And before I go much further into my reflections on it, Richard, do you want to share a takeaway that you have?
I was just going to say that I often come to Midrash skeptically because some of it just always feels so unrealistic, like, you know, Yaakov learning in a yeshiva and things like that. And so what I really appreciate that all of the teachers did this week was show how these Midrashim they picked, A, were really good ones, and B, really reflect something about the human condition that the rabbis are wrestling with. And to see it in that vein, I think, really raises the significance of the Midrashic project versus what I sometimes see happening in it. I appreciated that.
Yeah, that it's about understanding human experience more deeply. Marcia, what's a takeaway for you?
Not being very learned in Torah myself, I can barely read Hebrew. I was impressed overall how Midrash has been important in the survival of the Jewish people, because people are constantly learning and studying and thinking, questioning the Torah. And that to me is a marvelous thing, because there's so many different ways of interpretation. But what it all boils down to is that it perpetuates the values of the Jewish people, the basic things that are really important, saving the world, and how we can do it today constantly. By it refreshes the Jewish values, and it makes people more interested in helping the world, helping the neighbors, doing what we can to improve the world, to save the world. And I think it's so important now that we carry on this repair of the world, because the world really needs it. And we can't totally rely on the divine, as Rabbi Greenberg says.
We need to be partners in that work.
Self-reliance.
Thank you, Marcia. One of my favorite midrashim uses the language of cheder horati, that the Torah that we receive is given both at Sinai and from the Ohel Moed. And it talks about the Ohel Moed is parallel to a line in Shir HaShirim where it says, I brought him into my mother's house, into the room where I was conceived. And it says, this is like the Torah was given on Har Sinai, and then in the Ohel Moed, they were really taught the Torah. And I love that it uses this word hora'ah for conception to also be the word for teaching of Torah. And it's telling us in its way, I hear in it, that it's saying that the Torah is actually just the conception of these ideas in our relationship with God. And it is yet to have a whole life that we can bring by being in dialogue with it. So I wish you so many blessings in your continuing relationship with Torah and with Midrash. And I'm delighted that we get to learn a closing Midrash with Rav Aviva now.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you, Hannah. I do want to bring our attention together to one last piece of Midrash that we'll learn. And I want to share that one of the things that's so powerful about Midrash and metaphor in Midrash and expansiveness is once the Midrash has set up some sort of metaphor, then we can bring so much knowledge into what the text must mean. We'll only do a taste of it, but it's a sort of explosion of the idea that Torah is like water, which I think is a fairly well-known theme in Rabbinic Midrash, the comparison between Torah and water. And we can come up with all sorts of beautiful things about how Torah is like water and you need it to live and all sorts of stuff like that. We're going to focus on a Midrash that looks at Torah as water in terms of rain, right? Where does water come from? And once we're in the mode of thinking about Torah and rain, we can think about everything we know about rain, where rain comes from, what kinds of rain is good, what kind of rain is bad, what are the actual effects that rain has on our world, what are the sort of things you have to think about beyond rain when you're thinking about rain, the wind that brings the rain. Right, there's a sort of massive petach, right, massive opening that comes by just a simple connection between a piece of Torah and a broader idea. I will share just by word of, well, what kind of Midrash are we looking at? Because you've seen so many different kinds of Midrash. We're going to look at a passage in Sifrei Devarim, so early Midrash that's on the book of Devarim, Deuteronomy, from the same rabbis who brought us the Mishnah, same time period, so really our earliest form of Midrash. And I will say that there's things that we just take for granted about the rabbinic approach to Torah, things we take for granted about Torah Sheba Al Peh that are really elucidated for the first time in a work like this. And so we're going to look at section number 306, Shin Vav, which probably means very little to you as a number, but is on the passage, the part of the Torah, Parshat Ha'azinu, where Moshe sings his last song and the poem of Ha'azinu. And what is so powerful here in this section we're going to look at is that it sets up a real expansive vision of comparing Torah to water, specifically rain. And we know about this genre, this Sifrei, this work of Midrash. Stephen Froud, who's a professor of rabbinic literature, has written a book on Sifrei Devarim, this work of Midrash, and talked about how it really does so much to set up the posture that the rabbis have, that our sages have towards Torah, that it's a posture of attentiveness, relationship, love, that wasn't to be taken for granted. There was really work done in setting up that posture. So we're going to see some of that in this Midrash. But the last word of introduction I'll share is that I hope a takeaway you get from looking at this Midrash together is that Midrash is, but is not only, an opportunity to luxuriate in the dynamic beauty of Torah. The stakes are actually very high when it comes to Midrash. What we're going to see here is that the way we interface with Torah, the way Torah interfaces with our world, it can be life-giving or it can kill. That's not an overstatement in what we're going to see in this text. And so the responsibility that we have in how we interpret Torah, how we love Torah, but also how we interpret Torah and its effects more widely, but the stakes are actually very high in that. And in as much as like, I hope this was a lovely and enjoyable week of learning and that it did feel kind of luxurious, we also see here the sort of weight of our responsibility in interpreting Torah. Okay, so you're welcome to bring that text up on your own. I brought you excerpts and we'll only learn some of those excerpts. Rain, dew, wind, storm, the quest for nourishing Torah. We start with a verse from Devarim Ha'azinu. Ya'arof kamatar likhi, tizal katal imrati, kisirim ale desha vichir vivim ale esev. May my discourse likhi come down as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like showers on young growth, like droplets on the grass. And I hope you notice just in this verse, if nothing else substantive jumps out, just quantitatively from a poetic perspective, how many images we see for water just in this verse. We have rain, we have dew, we have showers, we have droplets. And that's really going to be the jumping off point for our midrash to explore all sorts of meanings for the what might be thought of as a kind of simple comparison between Torah and water. So the first part of this midrash sets up the metaphor, right? On face value, Moshe is just talking about his speech, the particular poem that he is giving over at this endpoint in his life. But we'll see that the midrash interprets this much more expansively. His discourse isn't only that poem, it's Torah as a whole. So, Ya'arof kamatar likhi, may my taking discourse come down as the rain. En likhi ela divrei Torah. This is our first move, right? Taking lekach and his discourse, that must refer to Torah. Okay, so that's move one. This poem and this metaphor about rain and dew is going to teach us about Torah more widely. We won't get into all these examples here, but you'll notice that there's a number of proof texts from the book of Mishlei, from Proverbs, to prove this point. And then they end up leaving us with three kind of different images of Torah as lekach, and that's a word that means something like taking. There's Torah as a gift, there's Torah as discipline, and in our last part of the Midrash here, there's Torah as an intermediary between us and God, quoting Hosea, Kechu imachem divarim, v'shuvu el Hashem, take words with you, return to God, right? That's Hosea asking that we come to God repentant, presumably asking us to draw on our own words of doing teshuvah, right? Instead, the Midrash reads that as Torah. Torah is what we can engage with to rebuild our relationship with God. So Torah as lekach, as a gift from God, Torah as discipline, something that really works on us, and Torah as an intermediary that's going to help cultivate and repair our relationship with God. Okay, those are just, that's just on the word lekach, but we'll jump from there now to what we're going to glean from this description of Torah as rain or dew. This I find surprising in this midrash. You might think that the picture it's going to paint of Torah is only beautiful, right? This is the closing scenes of the Torah at the end of Devarim. You might think it wants to leave us just with something beautiful, but we'll see here, and I hope you've seen all week, that midrash does not limit itself to that. It's willing to go to more difficult places and articulate more complex emotions in terms of our relationship to Torah. And here, I think just from a methodological perspective, part of the power, and I think somewhat confusing power of Midrash, is the role of the theoretical, the Hava Amina, what you might have thought, and then what Torah comes to explicitly kind of reject and teach you otherwise. Midrash takes the ink to articulate what it is that you might have thought and what it is that you should think. But by giving particular concrete language to the thing that you might have thought, I think it actually can kind of affirm that, even as it is at the same time pushing back and rejecting a particular train of thought. So you'll see what we mean here. Kamatar, as the rain. Mamatar chayim la'olam, af divrei Torah chayim la'olam. Water, rain brings life to the world, so too Torah. Very beautiful. E, that little tiny word, E, if. We're going to introduce our hypothetical. Actually, with rain, some of the world's happy about it, but some people are sad about the rain coming. What's an example? Someone whose pit or vat is full of wine, or their threshing floor is exposed to rain, right? If you have food items that could actually be ruined by the rain, then you're sad when the rain pours down. Af divrei Torah kein, could it also be true that Torah is not uniformly a life-giving and joy-inducing thing in the world? Tamun lomar tizal katalim rati. Right, actually the Torah doesn't stop at the rain metaphor. It says, may my words flow down as the dew, tizal katal. Just as with dew, the world is happy with it. The entire world is happy with it. Kol ha'olam smechim bo. Af divrei Torah, kol ha'olam kulo smechim bo. That's true about Torah too. It's actually not exactly like rain that has the possibility of being destructive. It's more like the gentleness of dew. And no one is saddened by it. Now, what I find powerful about this midrash is on the one hand, it's strongly asserting that nobody is ever sad by their encounter with Torah. But it has also articulated the possibility, the thought we could have had, that for some people, some of the time, Torah is a source of sadness or even harm or destruction. And I'm curious if people here have thoughts, can maybe put thoughts in the chat, about how you balance that tension in the Midrash, right? The articulation that Torah could be damaging, the assertion that it is never bad for anyone. How do those two ideas really sit side by side, right? Besides the very neat textual resolution. Luckily, we have the second phrase about dew. Torah as rain that can sometimes make some people sad. Torah as dew, uniformly a life-giving source for joy. Or maybe there's a problem of excess. Torah of excess or without maybe the proper system in place can be problematic. Great. Family, those we're in closest relationship with can be a source for great joy, but sometimes there can be hurt or pain. Torah like a wild animal. So yes, I do think that just seeing this hypothetical spelled out, it does actually invite us to reflect on times in our own lives, in what we've seen with others, that Torah has the potential to be a source of sadness or grief or harm. And then what I think the Midrash does by really asserting that Torah is like dew is that we're left with having an aspiration and vision that Torah always be something that is uniformly good, right? That actually there's an antithesis. It's antithetical to Torah to be something that could cause grief. And so if it is, then we have more work to do on how we interpret and understand it. Okay. I think one powerful piece here on naming the possibility for grief, asserting that vision, aspiration for true Torah to be something that is always a source of joy and life-giving. All right, we're going to skip this next piece so you can look at it on your own. The Torah that can be weary if we haven't done the kind of translation work that we need. But we're going to jump down to section 3 now, which I find also kind of amazing in the duplicity and the contrast of images that it leaves us with. So another explanation, Ya'arof Kamatar Likhi, Ya'arof, which we saw as meaning drip down, there's another meaning of this word. Rabbi Eliezer ben Yosha Rabbi Yossi Aglili Omer, Ein Ya'arof Ela Lashon Hariga. This verb, it's not the nice gentle dripping down, it's hariga, it's an act of killing. Shene Amar, we have our proof text from the ritual of breaking the heifer's neck, eglat arufa, in the case of an unsolved murder, right? The response to finding a dead body where no one is taking responsibility and no one can be found to be the person who killed this body. Right, the elders have to take a heifer and break the neck and say that they are absolved from any guilt. So it has there the verb, ayin resh pei ve'arfu sham et ha'agla banachal. They break the neck of the heifer. So our midrash says, just as the heifer with the broken neck atones for the spilling of blood, so words of Torah. Okay, so we have an idea here that Torah can bring atonement for even an act of murder, which on the one hand I think is beautiful and powerful and maybe in some ways an intertext with our opening plenary session about Cain and the act of murder. Torah can do even that, the hardest kind of work in the world, which is respond and construct, rebuild after the most devastating kind of event that could happen. But I also want to say that the process through which this happens as Ya'aruf, right, as breaking the neck, it's actually kind of doing two things here, that act of killing. There's the initial killing, the act of murder that occurred, and then there's the act of killing the heifer that comes for atonement in response. Right? On the one hand, that leaves us with some sense of resolution. On the other hand, the process of finding atonement could be difficult, could be a strain, right? Could be neck breaking, so to speak, to engage with Torah in a way that can achieve this power of kapara. So there's a lot of potential here, but it's also a little bit maybe dark or scary to think through what this process actually looks like. Right. A final note on this comparison between learning Torah and breaking the neck of the heifer, Aglat Arufa, is that it puts us into the position of the elders of the city who are responding to this unsolved murder, where yes, they are saying they're absolved, but that also essentially means that they are taking responsibility, right? For them to have to do a ritual of absolving themselves means that at their core, they were responsible. And so Torah here puts us into the position of feeling responsibility, accountability, certainly awareness of everything like that unsolved murder, all the unresolved kind of mess of the world that we live in, the world around us. Our engagement with Torah is stepping into our sense of responsibility and accountability towards that, even as it is hopefully giving us some sort of constructive mode for atonement. Okay, our next phrase in this midrash that ties us to atonement here is si'irim. Si'irim al-desha, which we translated as showers initially. Si'irim are also the two goats that are brought on Yom Kippur to bring atonement for transgression. So again, right, Torah as a mode for atonement. But again, part of turning to Torah for atonement means that when we're engaging with Torah, we become aware of all of those unresolved transgressions that exist in the world. We're going to skip the next piece, but it is essentially, again, talking about Ya'aruf as some kind of back-breaking sort of word and getting us to Moshe's experience of learning Torah for 40 days and 40 nights, not as some kind of amazing, divine, beautiful journey, but as a painful process. And Moshe tells us when we learn Torah, it may also be painful to learn the Torah that we need to learn. We'll look at this last section, which is the most explicit here on the potential of Torah to do great good and get great harm. So, davar acher, ya'aruf kamatar likhi, Haya Rabbi Bina'a Omer, Ima Sita Divrei Torah Lishmam, if you are doing Torah out of some kind of pure intention for their own sake, Divrei Chayim Hemlach, then they're going to bring you life. And he brings his proof text. Ulechol Bisaro Marpe, Torah as a source of healing for your whole body. V'im lo asita divrei Torah lishman, if you're not learning Torah for its own sake, whatever that might mean, divrei Torah mimitim otach. The words of Torah are actually going to kill you. It's not any less drastic than that, this statement. How do we know the words of Torah are going to kill you? Shenamar ya'arof kamatar likri. We have our verb, ya'arof, which again could mean drip, but could also mean to break and to kill. Ve'en arifa ela hariga. By breaking is killing, and it brings us back to, again, the red heifer, eglat arufa, and it brings us to a verse from Proverbs that says, ki rabim halalim hepila va'atsumim harugeha. She has taken many lives. The number of his victims are a legion. Now, this is very interesting, because if you actually open up the book of Proverbs, which hopefully, if nothing else, after our learning this week, you would do first thing after you learn Midrash, do you see that this is about Isha Zara? It's not about wisdom. It's about the foreigner, the other that would lead you astray, which in the book of Proverbs seems to be kind of false wisdom. Right, something that might pretend, right, have an allure of being wisdom, but is actually going to lead you astray. That's what this verse is about. Right? But I think what you see here, and it's scary to confront this as a reality so starkly in the Midrash, but I find it also incredibly, incredibly important and kind of eyes wide open of a stance, is what the Midrash is telling us is if we learn Torah wrong, God help us in identifying what wrong means, then we actually are not learning Torah at all. We are learning the opposite of Torah in Proverbs, the opposite of Chochmah, of wisdom, that will lead us astray. And that will actually lead to nothing less than incredibly devastating harm and loss of life instead of what it's supposed to do, which is to give life. So I share this not to just end on some kind of dark note, but as a reminder of, and the stakes are so high in how we learn Torah and what we allow it to bring to the world. So with that, I want to close with the last piece of this Midrash, which I find to be incredibly beautiful and also incredibly empowering and kind of comforting. If we don't entirely know what the Midrash is telling us we must know, which is learning that Torah that's going to be life-giving rather than that Torah that could actually bring devastation or grief to the world. If we're not quite sure how it is to get there, hopefully this Midrash leaves us with a little bit of comfort. So this is section number 4. Ya'arof kamatar. Not as rain that comes from the south, which is all for blast, meaning it ruins the crops, mildew and curse, but as the rain which comes from the west, which is all for blessing. Right? And here's something where the Pasuk doesn't say anything about south or west, but I think what we see here is, well, once I've made a connection between Torah and rain, then as a farmer, which I am not, but the author of this Midrash might have been, I know a lot about rain. And I'm going to bring what I know about rain to this metaphor. And that means I know that there's a good rain and there's a bad rain. And that's going to affect my interpretation of what it means to compare Torah to rain. So here's where our Midrash takes a turn, introducing the vector of wind into our comparison of Torah and rain. And that's not just like interesting, right? The point is where the rain comes from and where it's going to, the direction, the wind that gives direction to the rain, right? The context, the purpose is all going to be important for how we think about Torah and what's necessary to make a Torah that's life-giving. So the last piece of this Midrash, once we've introduced the idea of wind, skip some of this again, you can look at this much more on your own if you'd like, is going to bring us to another passage in the Tanakh, in the Bible, about wind and breath and life. Okay, so we're going to scroll down here to the very last passage, the interpretation of Rabbi Simai on this verse in Ha'azinu. And just remember that this poem starts in Ha'azinu Hashamayim Va'adabeira Tishma Ha'aretz Imrifi. Moshe first calls the heavens and the earth to bear witness, and then says, may my discourse fall like rain. So Rabbi Simai draws on this heavens and earth to understand what this part about rain means also. And he says, all the creatures created from the earth, their spirit and their body are from the earth, except for humans, whose spirit is from heaven and body from earth. So we are hybrids. We are Shamayim and Aretz hybrids. Therefore, if a person learns Torah and does the will of their parent in heaven, of God, they're like celestial creatures, then we can be like we are of the heaven. If one does not learn Torah and do the will of their parent in heaven, then we're like lower creatures. Then we are like Eretz. And so we see here that Torah is kind of the particular fuel that we, as Shamayim Aretz hybrids, as hybrids between the celestial and the embodied, we need Torah as our fuel in order to rise to become all that we can be. Here's the piece that I want to leave you with. Rabbi Simai would say, "En lecha parasha she'ein bat triyat amitim." There is no part of the Torah that does not deal with, somehow allude to, resurrection of the dead, triyat amitim. Every single part of the Torah is connected to the concept of bringing life from death. Ela, she'en banu koach lidrosh. We just don't have the energy or the strength to expound that, to find that hidden there. Every part of the Torah is connected to this idea of revival, of life-giving force, even to the point of bringing the dead back to life. And we all need that, and we maybe know we need that, but we might not have the strength to find that. So this gives us a sense of the incredible power and potential in what Torah can offer, and also notes the limits of our capacity to find what we know must be there. He closes with an image from Yechezkel, the valley of dry bones, where God calls the winds from the four corners to come and revive the dead. And I have that pasuk right here. Vayomer Elai, Hinaveh al haruach, Hinaveh ben adam, Va'amart al haruach, Ko amar Adonai Elohim, Me'ar baruchot bo'i haruach, u'fichi baharugim ha'ela vichyu. Right? Come, breath, from the four winds, breathe into these slain, that they may live again. And I close with this image because I think in the flow of this midrash, right, what it's seeing in Moshe's comparison between Torah and rain is also the importance of the wind, right, where that rain is coming from, where it's going to. And we see here that our interface with Torah is essentially nothing less than embodying this particular scene where the wind and the breath comes and animates us. And just as we saw here that Torah has the potential power to kill, we also see that every single word of Torah, every part of Torah, has the capacity to bring life to the dead. And that's the Torah that is the real Torah, Torah Lishma. And it may be scary and dangerous to try to find it, and it may feel elusive. En banu koach lidrosh, we might not have the capacity to find it there. But that's the sort of promise and the assurance of what Torah must be. So I hope you have a sense of what could give you a little bit more koach lidrosh, right? A little bit more of a sense of what's in my toolkit from a technical perspective, from an emotional perspective. And do we have a little more capacity to be finding the absolutely uniformly only thing that Torah must be, which is something that has the capacity to give life, even to the dead? And I feel especially where we are in thinking back on this year and the intensity of loss of this year, we need the power of that Torah to bring life. And hopefully we have both an awareness of the potential for our interface with Torah to go wrong, but hopefully that can just motivate us even more to always be on this quest for Torah that is life-giving. Thank you so much. I hope that you all feel like we have a few more partners in finding our koach lidrosh, our power to seek out that life-giving Torah, and maybe also partners in helping us identify which Torah is which, when it's going in the direction that it needs to be going in, and when it may be going in a more destructive direction. Obviously, it can be hard to know, but I do feel it's so powerful to have partners in this learning together. We'll see you again soon. Do more learning, and you all will with each other as well. Yishar koach.
Hi, welcome to Tashma, the podcast where you get to listen in on Hadar's Beit Midrash. I'm Rabbi Avi Killip, and I'm excited to be your host. On this podcast, you will find recordings from recent Hadar lectures and programs with short introductions by me. This episode of Tashma was produced by Rabbi Effie Unterman with help from Rebecca Kersner and edited by Evan Feist. I'm your host, Rabbi Avi Killip. It has been a pleasure to learn with you.